Thank you very much indeed, Ray, for those kind words and that very generous introduction. Ladies and gentlemen, what I'm proposing to do is to talk for about half an hour, and then we'll perhaps be able to have some questions and discussion. And what I was going to do was to talk, first of all, about be a bit autobiographical and talk about how I got interested in this bloke, and then say a little bit about his great work, the Commentaries on the Laws of England, and then talk about how Blackstone is not to be thought of simply in terms of his great work, but look at Blackstone, as it were, outside the commentaries and the things that Blackstone did and the attributes and accomplishments which he had, which in some ways really help explain why the commentaries were such a great success. And then finally, I'm going to try to deal with what is sometimes known as the so what question. Okay, well, why should we care? So that's roughly, and I'm going to try and keep these four bits to each to about 7.5 minutes. We'll see how we go. Well, I always have to look at... I think I'd probably do better with a digital watch, but 7.5 minutes. Right, okay. Well, first of all, Blackstone and me. Perhaps I should put Blackstone up so we can see who I'm talking about. I suppose that I must have heard Blackstone's name invoked when I did my one and only law subject at the University of Melbourne in 1958. But if it was invoked, it was invoked simply as Blackstone as the author of the commentaries. And the commentaries have been the sort of starting point, but a rather stuffy starting point for modern law. And anyway, I decided I didn't want to be a lawyer, and I was much more interested in history, and so I gladly gave up Introduction to Legal Method at the end of my first year, and didn't really hear very much more about this chap. He came in a bit, I suppose, in some of the later British history that I studied, some 18th and 19th century British history. But he was referred to when an author wanted to establish, as it were, what the law was in about the time of George III. And that was more or less it. And I wasn't really terribly interested at that stage in that period. My main interest was actually in a rather earlier period. I wanted to find out why the English had a civil war in the middle of the 17th century. And so I found myself eventually writing a thesis looking at the legal training institutions, the Inns of Court in London, which at that time were not legal training institutions solely. They were also really gentlemen's academies, and actually more members of the Long Parliament, the one which went to war with Charles I, ended up, were graduates of the Inns of Court and were graduates of the university. So the Inns of Court were pretty important, and I spent some time working on them. Now, the interesting thing about the Inns of Court was, although they were the place where barristers were trained, barristers weren't really terribly well trained at all. There wasn't a very systematic mode of legal education. And in fact, there were quite a few complaints about how difficult it was to learn the law, because the law was such a disorderly body of knowledge. There weren't really any general books that you could go to understand the law. English law was in the reports, the judgments of the courts and so on, and there were a few attempts to put those together in perhaps an alphabetical order, but really it was a great mess, and students complained a lot about it. And there were attempts to, as you might imagine, in those circumstances, to systematise the law. And I got interested in one of the blokes who was doing this, a man called Henry Finch. And he applied methods that he'd post-scholastic logic, which he had picked up as an undergraduate at Cambridge University in the period of the reign of Elizabeth. And I got interested in the various stages by which this fellow Finch, over a period of about 40 years, worked up from a tiny little sketch to systematizing the law to a published text, which actually exists in various manuscript forms, and I got involved in trying to sort out when he wrote these things and what they all meant. And in that process, I came across a book by Blackston called The Analysis of the Laws of England, which was in some ways the sketch, and we've got a copy of The Analysis of the Laws of England out on that display, which I do suggest you, many of you will have seen it. There's a display of Blackston books over by the entrance, and this, I suppose, is the inspiration for this talk. So, and in the preface to his analysis of the laws of England, Blackston says that really weren't any previous examples of successful attempts to get English law into a coherent and systematic form that students could, as it were, approach and make sense of. And except he singled out a few people. He singled out Bracton back in the Middle Ages. And then he singled out Henry Finch and said that Henry Finch's method would almost have been sufficient to make it unnecessary for him, Blackston, to do what he was doing, but for the fact that the law had changed quite a lot since Henry Finch's time. So that struck me. So Blackston sort of saw himself as being at the end of a sequence of lawyers who were trying to make English law a more coherent and teachable sort of discipline. Okay, so, well, then I myself started to get more interest in the 18th century. And a dear friend of mine, or he's become a dear friend, I didn't know him terribly well then, who was appointed to be one of the editors of the New Oxford Dictionary of National Biography, asked me if there was something if there was anybody I'd like to work on in the period, chronological period, which he'd been allocated for as one of the editors. And I said, oh, gee, is anyone doing Blackston? He said, no. So I said, oh, well, give Blackston, have a go at Blackston. And I just thought this would be an interesting sort of learning experience. Well, I discovered, in fact, there wasn't a great deal that was worth reading about Blackston. In fact, there's a lot of stuff about Blackston's book, about the commentaries, but about the man himself, not so much. So I spent about 3 months in late 1998 at the National Humanities Centre, a marvellous institution, and Research Triangle Park in North Carolina, doing my 6,000-word article on Blackston and for the Oxford Dictionary of National Biography. And on the whole, and by and large, I was working from fairly accessible sort of sources, the kind of things that were either in print or that I could get on microfilm fairly easily. But as part of this marvellous gathering of scholars, we had a biography seminar, a very informal meeting in the second part of the year, of people who had biographical interests. And my colleagues more or less persuaded me that I ought to write, that Blackston's biography ought to be written. And I could see that this was something that did need to be done, that this man was being very much overshadowed by his book, and that the existing biographies, for all sorts of reasons, were inadequate. And so I applied for an ARC fellowship when I got back to Australia. Of course, the first time I didn't get it. But as is the way with ARC fellowships, I applied again, and fortune smiled, and I got that fellowship and a project to write a biography of Blackston and also to supervise a graduate student working on Blackston's architectural manuscripts, which was one of the things that I'd got interested in as I was writing my piece for the ODNB. Okay, so that's Blackston and me, and I'm at the stage now where I'm almost finished. I've written 100,000 words. I've got about another 20,000 words to go of the biography, which is what the ARC, what you are all paying for as taxpayers, what you've been supporting me for the last 5 years. I promised them that I'd get it finished in 5 years. It's going to be more like 5.5 years, but it's going to be done. Okay, well, the book itself that justifies this character. He's shown here just in at the time that his the first volume of his commentaries on the laws of England came into print. I think the volume that he's got in his hand. This painting by Tilly Kettle is in the is in the Bodleian Library. I only actually saw the original this year. It's down in the photocopying room. You know, they've got to put these portraits somewhere. They've got an awful lot of them. And it's hung up rather high, so it's a bit difficult to see. But I think that he's probably the book he's resting his finger on is probably not his commentaries. I think it's probably his edition of Magna Carta, which came out in 1759, a remarkable work of scholarship. But he's about to publish the first of these four volumes. Now, these four volumes are based upon the lectures on English law which Blackstone had been giving at the University of Oxford since 1753. So he's giving lectures on the English law at the University of Oxford, turns into a book. Fair enough. Oh, that's right. Well, it's actually quite an amazing feat because, first of all, at Oxford in the 18th century, there are not too many lectures. Well, there are some lectures that are done in a rather formal kind of way. The professors, on the whole, don't bother to lecture. The college tutors lecture, and some people go along and some people don't. You can still graduate. It's a rather... This is a period when Oxford University is not at, shall we say, its academic height. It provides Adam Smith, who is, of course, a student at Balliol College. Adam Smith, born the same year as Blackstone, 1733, and goes up to Balliol College. They're actually contemporaries. I don't know whether they met in Oxford. But his experience at Balliol College provides Adam Smith with his strongest argument for the notion that university academics can't be trusted. That the only way you're going to get decent teaching is if they are paid directly by their students. This idea may be for you. It's still around, I gather. I think we've heard bits about this, vouchers and that sort of thing. Anyway, it was an extraordinary undertaking. Firstly, just to offer a course of lectures. They were private lectures. You had to pay a fee. You had to be a university student, an enrolled, matriculated student, but you still paid a fee to go along. Lecturing was a fairly fashionable thing at this time outside the universities. In the university, people were very worried. They thought that this sort of modern subject, studying law, there were lectures, of course, there was teaching in Roman law, in civil law, but not in English common law, because that was thought to be a barbarous discipline. The university is still dominated by its ecclesiastical foundations, its ecclesiastical origins. And the clergy thought that canon law was all right, or civil law at a pinch, but common law was barbarous, and lawyers were probably of suspect orthodoxy. So Blackstone puts on these lectures. They're very successful. He puts them on partly because he's tried practicing at the bar himself as a common lawyer, having graduated first in Roman law in the university, but then practiced at London. He's not terribly successful. There's all sorts of reasons for that. We can talk about that a bit more, if you like, in question time. And he goes on lecturing very successfully. It's actually quite a profitable business. But yeah, I think he perhaps gets a bit bored with it. After a time, people do get a bit bored with lecturing after a time. not me, but it does happen. And there's a problem that his notes become commodified. People start circulating. There are copies of his notes which are passed on and they acquire a market value. And he's worried that copies of these notes may not be accurate, but also, you know, in a way, people might be happy just to have the notes and not pay the fee to go along to the lectures. Also, he's gone back to the bar. He's gone back to legal practice, and if he's going to practice full time in London, he doesn't really want to be having to spend periods of time four times a year giving lectures in Oxford. So he decides to put his lectures into print, and in that way, what really began in the 1750s. And was worked over very, very carefully, tremendous sort of preparation, actually gets into print in four volumes between 1765 and 69. And it takes off. The analysis, which was a kind of plan, the sketch plan of the lectures, a syllabus of the lectures, which had been published 4 years after the lectures began and had been very successful itself. There were as many as 6 editions of the analysis, each of a thousand copies. That's pretty good. That had been successful, but the commentaries were a runaway success. Published 1,500 copies of each volume. The second edition was called for before the first edition had more or less sold out. And there are 8 more editions during Blackstone's lifetime, and then, I forget the figures, but 25, 35, up to the middle of the 19th century, almost as many, and by the end of the 19th century, more editions in the United States, where the book was enormously popular right from the beginning. So it was a great publishing success. It was so popular in the United States, really, because it provided the basis for the academic teaching of law. Although Blackstone had started academic teaching law in England, he was pushing uphill. Universities, as we know, are very conservative institutions. And here, there were people who said that these lectures and then the commentaries themselves would take the young men away from their books, which meant, of course, from the classical curriculum, from the logic, the philosophy, and so forth, which was the basis of Oxford's curriculum, really up until the reforms of the 19th century. And it must be said that after Blackstone left Oxford, although law teaching did continue, common law teaching, English law teaching continued, it was not really until the middle of the 19th century that got going very much as an effective competitor to the existing academic enterprises. In the United States, on the other hand, academic law teaching was quite big from the end of the 18th century and continued. And Blackstone was the basis of that teaching. Blackstone, if you knew law in America, you knew Blackstone. And this remained the case even into the 20th century. And there's a marvellous example out on that in that display of something from the Chicago LaSalle Extension University Law School, where it's basically a correspondence school for lawyers. And in the latest 1953, they were reprinting a lecture on Blackstone's, or sort of a summary of Blackstone's commentaries, which was intended for would-be lawyers to absorb as a kind of basic introduction to law. Even to American law, because the scheme that Blackstone provides can be very easily adapted, it is very easily adapted across the Atlantic, as in some ways even more so than in its native country. Again, we can say more about that later. Now, I must move on. Blackstone outside the commentaries, how is he able to do this, to be so successful? Well, first of all, he has studied Roman law, and that helps him in various ways. That gives him various categories for organising his material. But lots of people, well, not lots, but it wasn't all that uncommon for a common lawyer, an English lawyer, to have studied English, to have studied Roman law at university before going to the bar in London. The other things that Blackstone had, though, were unique. Blackstone was a poet, and he was really a poet of quite considerable standing. I'm not going to try and do too many of these things. We can perhaps do them a bit later. His first publication, indeed, is a piece of poetry. It's published anonymously, as all Blackstone's work is until the analysis of the law. Again, we have a copy in the display case there. This is a 400-line verse essay in comparative theology. It is written before Blackstone turns 21. It is published in 1647, when he is, what, 23. It's actually quite gripping. But when you make the necessary allowances there has to be a certain amount of willing suspension of disbelief. It's a story of the various forms of human religion, from animistic religions through the Druids, Islam, Hebrew religion, or Hebrew religion, Islam, then the Roman Church, the Reformation churches, and then the Church of England, which comes out, of course, top. But it shows that Blackstone has a sort of an ear for words and an ear for and a sense of language, the ability to create gripping images, and that is, I think, one of the key. Everybody agrees that the commentaries owed much of their effect to the fact that they were quite an easy read. If you like 18th century prose, you know, it's maybe a slightly acquired taste these days, but some of us here can cope, I think. And if you... Well, the other thing, and perhaps I will show you an image here now. Blackstone was a bit of an infant prodigy, and one of his earliest interests was in architecture. And while he was writing the Pantheon, he was also putting together a volume on architecture. An exposition. Well, there were two of these manuscripts. The first one completed before he was 21, the second about the same time as the Pantheon was published. And the elements of architecture from which this rather elegant illustration comes is essentially a run-through of the basic parts of classical architecture as interpreted by Vitruvius and then by his 16th century Italian successor, Palladio. The thing is that Blackstone here is having a dry run of putting together a complex body of knowledge for essentially didactic purposes, for pedagogic purposes. This elements of architecture is an attempt to expound an intellectual discipline, which is how architecture is seen, in a readily accessible form for people who are interested. Gentlemen, probably, as he regards, as he expects his students at Oxford to be. He has this interest in architecture. He has a great interest in history. Indeed, he might well, if things had turned out differently, have become a historian. There were rumours in Oxford in 1756 that he was actually waiting for the then Camden Professor of Ancient History to expire, so that he would be able to step into Dr. Frewen's shoes. And that interest in architecture is very apparent through the commentaries. He explains the rationale of legal institutions in historical terms. He explains how they got to be that way through taking an historical approach. And in some ways, the commentaries on the laws of England is as much a general history of English law and English government as it is an exposition of particular details of the workings and doctrines of English law. He's also interested in politics and government. And as I say, although his book is called Commentaries on the Laws of England, the first volume is effectively an overview. We call it a civics text. It's effectively a description of how England is governed in the middle of the 18th century, the Constitution and the working of the Constitution. And he has that interest in university politics. He's involved very much in reforming Oxford University Press. It was an ongoing task, no doubt, but he went in there, and there's a study by Ian Phillip in the display, which deals with his role as the reformer of Oxford University Press. He's also a member of Parliament. He serves in Parliament. He's elected in 1761, 4 years before the commentaries are finished, and are actually published. And that experience probably helps him to understand a bit more about how legislatures actually work as distinct from how, in principle or in theory, a parliament operates. And a final, perhaps somewhat unusual interest for an 18th century Englishman, he's interested in social justice and law reform. He is concerned with the inequalities that exist, for example, that allow, in the game laws, that allow large landholders to range over the estates of their tenants in pursuit of beasts of in pursuit of deer and rabbits and hares and so forth. He's concerned about, and he has a great deal about the game laws in the commentaries. He's concerned about the inequality of representation in the parliament that exists in the England of his time. He suggests that there should be wider representation. Doesn't push this very hard, but he makes it clear he doesn't think it's an ideal situation. He's particularly concerned with criminal law, the harshness of the bloody code, the indiscriminate proliferation of capital statutes, even if not actually enforced, and the lack of rehabilitation as an end of criminal justice. He's a reader of the Italian criminologist Cesario Beccaria, whose work he reads very shortly after it is published in the mid-1760s, and which he incorporates very much in the fourth volume of the commentaries. And he is effectively responsible for the first attempt to establish, as an alternative to capital punishment or corporal punishment or transportation, imprisonment, the penitentiary, as a means of punishment available as an option in the penal justice system. Now, we might think, you know, prisons are pretty awful places. No doubt they are. But if you think what the alternatives were in the 18th century, there's something to be said. Blaxton didn't actually succeed. The bill went through, turned into law. Blaxton died in the same year that it was passed, and there were all sorts of administrative reasons why it wasn't until the early 19th century that the first penitentiary was constructed in the UK. But I'm making the point that this was an interest in rehabilitation. That was the aim for Blaxton of the penitentiaries. Well, finally, so what? I know I recognise I'm getting a bit close to the end of my time. So what? Why should we worry about Blaxton? Well, I think that the more one knows about any author, the better one understands the book that that author wrote, or the books that that author wrote. And in Blaxton's case, there's the image of Sir William Blaxton, the rather solid figure whom I encountered in the Coddington Library of All Souls College, the statue by the sculptor John Bacon, which sits in the Coddington Library. That sort of image, I think, tends to, the image of Blaxton as judge, tends to overshadow the younger and in many ways more radical and more interesting man, much more multidimensional than the standard images of Sir William Blaxton suggest. Blaxton's also important, I think, because in a way the struggle between Blaxton and his great adversary Jeremy Bentham in some ways still continues. Blaxton's someone who believes, who's interested in history, who wants to try and work with existing institutions. Bentham is not at all interested in history. He wants to abolish the existing institutions of English law and many other English institutions and reconstruct them in accordance with the principle of utilitarianism. Blaxton was not... there is still, I think, in some ways, you could say that the conflict between those two worldviews is still one which continues in our own day. And the final reason why I think that Blaxton is worth studying for us here in Australia is perhaps summed up by this stained glass window from the Great Hall of Sydney University. I'll try and get it the right way around. Not a very good picture, I'm afraid. But it's a rather interesting one. You'll recognise Captain Cook on the one side. Probably won't recognise Joseph Black, the inventor of latent heat, the Scottish chemist of the 18th century. These are all roughly contemporaries. A series of 36 windows in the Great Hall put together in the 1850s by a London firm representing British wordies, men of science and others. In the middle of them, Sir William Blaxton. And, of course, Blaxton's commentaries came out with the First Fleet, and Blaxton still remains a very significant authority in Australian law today. The High Court, I understand, cites Blaxton in their judgments, second only to Quicken Garran on the Australian Constitution. And, of course, Blaxton's ideas about the transmission of law to plantations have still resonances for issues today to do with native title and so forth. So those are my answers to people who say, why do you bother with William Blaxton?